And now to a story from a granddaughter about the loss of her family's farm in Rancho Palos Verdes. Writer Caroline Hatano brings us an ode to the Japanese-American community that once farmed all over Southern California. Her story comes to us as part of a collaboration with Civil Eats, which is a daily news source for critical thought about the American food system. Here's Caroline.
For most of my 20s, I fantasized about working on a farm. I'd wake up with the birds and spend most of my time outside, learning about things like soil, pests, and tractors. The plants themselves would teach the more conceptual subjects on tenacity and growth. This version of myself would be more attuned to nature and to herself. The kind of knowing that I imagined could only come from true solitude, away from technology and the white noise of everyday life. I didn't realize it then, but my daydreaming wasn't just a coping mechanism. It was largely a yearning for connection with my Japanese heritage and the side of my family I share it with. They'd been farming in California since immigrating, and growing up, our relationship had mostly boiled down to annual pleasantries. Aside from my grandma, my bachan, she always showed up at my horse shows and volleyball games with a bag of salty tengu beef jerky in hand. Last year, on the brink of turning 30, I finally hit pause on the college to corporate America pipeline to work on a vegetable farm. At my 9-to-5 job, I'd been a senior editor at a small content agency. But on the farm, I was just another apprentice wearing Carhartt, plastering bandages on my cracked hands. Each week, we'd seed new plants in the greenhouse, transplant young ones out in the fields, and harvest as fast as we could. Every Wednesday, we packed boxes for the weekly CSA in an assembly line, usually with the Alabama Shake song, Hold On, setting the pace. Bless my heart, bless my soul. Before I ever even touched a harvest knife, I knew my favorite crop would be sunflowers. I loved getting lost in the towering rows, tilting each sunny stalk down to check how many petals had popped, stumbling to the truck with as many as I could sling across each arm. With each harvest, I was reminded of my grandpa, my Jichon. Some 70 years ago, he'd sized up his newly leased plot of land and decided to gamble on the very same flower. His farm had been in Rancho Palos Verdes, a coastal LA suburb straight off a tourism poster, with dramatic rolling hills and cliffs to match. When I talked to my dad, Dwight Hatano, about my Jichon, we agree that his passion for farming was always clear.
I mean, Jichon was obviously very proud to be a farmer. I don't think that was ever really like a question for me growing up. He loved it so much.
Yeah. And, you know, Jichon, his whole being was you don't brag, you don't talk about yourself, but you can tell he was proud of what he did and then the product he was putting out there. You know, the happiest place was when he was at, for him, when he was the happiest was always being out at the farm.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what was his purpose in life, his reason for living.
My Jichon died in 2015, well into his 80s and just a year after retiring. I had a kind of awakening when I realized I'd missed my opportunity to connect with him in a meaningful adult way. Not long after I wrapped up my apprenticeship, I learned that his farm, which had continued to operate, would soon be forced to close. Like many farmers in the U.S., he'd rented his land and the city was terminating his lease. For my family, it meant the end of an era. But his farm also happened to be the last Japanese-American founded farm on a peninsula that was once home to hundreds of them. And this past summer, it closed forever.
Probably my first memories are working at the ranch with my dad and going out there on Saturdays, which was, you know, that was kind of our family time, family day.
I grew up hearing stories about what the peninsula used to be like, back when it was crowded with strawberry and garbanzo bean farms run by Japanese Americans.
You know, as little kids, we, because the farms were so close, we just ride our bikes down there and run in there and start helping out. You know, we thought we were helping out, or if they were out in the fields, we'd go and pick tomatoes or pick strawberries with the workers.
Sometimes my dad and his siblings would go pigeon hunting as a low-tech method of pest control. Or they'd join another farm kid named Satoshi on the combine, a sort of tractor-like harvesting machine.
Satoshi would drive the combines with the garbanzo beans. And so they cut the garbanzo beans and feed it into the combine, and it would throw shell them into the back. So we used to go there, and I'd go running after him, and he'd stop and let me climb up, and we'd ride with him. And those were, that was usually on Saturdays and Sundays, you know, because it was the weekend.
Now the area is home to a Trump golf course, a luxury resort, and neat rows of identical houses. All thanks to the Japanese-American community who'd been working the land since 1882, transforming it from desert into fertile farmland. Together, many of the farmers pioneered dry farming techniques that are still in use today, as California's climate only continues to get hotter and drier. Despite anti-Asian land laws that kept them from owning farmland until 1952, Japanese farmers managed to be incredibly successful up and down the West Coast. By the 1910s, they were already generating $16 million of the $25 million flower market business in L.A., which is where my Jichon eventually ended up raising sunflowers in baby's breath.
He was very prideful in the fact that his baby's breath, it was whiter, the flowers were whiter and bigger. And so you compare them to other growers' baby's breath, and it just wasn't the same. And that's why, you know, his was so much in demand.
Of course, all that progress was interrupted in 1942 when 120,000 Japanese people on the West Coast were incarcerated in concentration camps. Most of them were American citizens. And it was white growers who benefited from the subsequent price spikes due to crop shortages. It's no coincidence that today, white landowners still control an estimated 98% of farmland in the U.S. In the subsequent years of incarceration, many Japanese Americans lost their land, had equipment stolen, and were forced into agricultural work in the camps. After the war, the USDA estimates that Japanese farm ownership, including leases, dropped to less than a quarter of what it had been. My Jichon had been incarcerated in the Poston, Arizona camp as a teenager, eventually leaving his family to help fight the war against Japan. In the meantime, my great-grandparents relocated to the L.A. area after hearing about its Japanese farming community from friends at camp. It wasn't until the 50s that my Jichon leased his peninsula plot from the military. When Rancho Palos Verdes was incorporated some 20 years later in 1973, part of the agreement mandated that the land he was farming be converted to recreational use. Whether it was out of guilt, respect, or plain old bureaucratic disorganization, the city allowed my Jichon to renew his lease anyway until 2014. That was the year he retired and transferred the lease to Martin Martinez, who had started working with him at the farm as a teenage immigrant from Mexico. Allowing his legacy to live on through Martinez would have been especially meaningful, as he represents another oppressed community that forms the backbone of California agriculture. When my Jichon's lease expired this summer, with it went our community's only tangible tie to the land we nurtured and made viable. Land that provided Japanese Americans with livelihoods, camaraderie, and an anchor in times of great turbulence and terror. And although the city is pursuing a historical designation to try to preserve that history, it doesn't feel equitable in any sense. A plaque doesn't maintain a sense of place. And this story isn't singular, which naturally leads to a string of what-ifs. If Japanese Americans had never been sent to prison camps, if we didn't continue to face discriminatory laws after the war, if we hadn't suffered devastating economic setbacks, would my Jichon have been able to buy land? Would property ownership alone have dramatically changed California's agricultural landscape? Of course, leasing farmland is still common practice today. According to the USDA, more than half of cropland in the U.S. is rented. One of the biggest barriers to entry for new farmers is an inability to acquire land. And because many white families already own land in some form, farming remains a white industry. The hierarchy, with white landowners at the top and immigrant laborers at the bottom, stays intact by structural design. Before I started my apprenticeship, I wondered if one season would be enough to fulfill my farming fantasy. Now, a full year out, I often find myself drifting back to the easy routine of last summer, of spending all day with my hands in the dirt, playing Marco Polo in the sunflower fields, of driving home with the windows down, smelling like sweat and tomato plants. Farming offers an opportunity to feed people. but also to build collective knowledge, establish traditions, and honor shared history. And eventually, I hope, to challenge the status quo. One of the things I like most about farming is that you're always building on your own work. Over time, you create the kind of soil you want. Each season, you review last year's notes and make adjustments to improve yield. It's a practice that rewards patience. In some ways, turning soil over is almost like burying our dead. Cover crops and sunflower stalks become food for the next generation, which means that long after you've left land behind, there's always evidence you were there. So although my Jichon's farm might no longer physically exist, in every plant that blooms up and down the peninsula, there will be a small piece of him and the community he belonged to. And that's something no one can take away.
Writer Carolyn Hatano. Her essay about her grandfather's farm in Palos Verdes comes to us through the nonprofit news organization Civil Eats.